You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In a recent debate, Michael Hayden asserted that the U.S. kills people based on metadata, although when he was director of the NSA, he suggested the agency wasn't really collecting that much data. So what was the government actually doing? How did it come to monitor and collect what we now know to be an incredible amount? And what has it done to hide what they called the program from the American public? Michael Kirk and Martin Smith pieced together the history and scale of government spying post 9/11 step by step in a two-part documentary for PBS's Frontline series. Part one of The United States of Secrets, How the Government Came to Spy on Millions of Americans, airs tomorrow night at 9 p.m. on PBS's Frontline. And part two will be next Tuesday at 10. I'm very pleased that it brings Michael Kirk to our show today. Hello.
Hi, Leonard.
And you've called tomorrow night's segment The Program. What was or is the program?
The program was what happened in the immediate, what was created in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, when the NSA, which had been prohibited since the 1970s from using its eyes and ears to look inward in America, began to do something much more aggressive, and that was turn what it knew and what it could learn and what it could develop technologically on gathering the data of everybody, telephone data, internet data, emails, everything you can imagine, inside the United States and outside, to the extent that it became it is a program that essentially has as its ambition gathering all the information that you can gather about everybody and storing it for some undisclosed future use.
In your film, people claim that the domestic spying apparatus went dark for more than 20 years after the Nixon administration overstepped. What had the NSA or others been doing during the Nixon administration or before? The NSA was created in 1952, wasn't it?
The NSA is created in the sort of aftermath of Pearl Harbor, late 40s, early 50s. The genesis of the idea comes in the aftermath of Pearl Harbor. The sense, the impulse in America that, you know what, we don't want to ever be taken by surprise again. It was
Wouldn't the CIA have done that?
Absolutely, but it was what the NSA was something new, which was signals intelligence, yeah, and that was radio and telegraph and other means of communication were going to become their way of throwing a dragnet out there, primarily around the world. But eventually, of course, in the 70s, used by the Nixon administration and others to spy, even, I mean, the revelations of that we're all familiar with about Martin Luther King and others, the NSA played a role in all of that, the Jane Fonda. You know, there were many incidences that when Senator Frank Church, the Idaho senator, formed a committee, and the Senate and the Congress actually spanked the NSA pretty hard, and a law was created in the wake of all of that called the FISA Act. And it was the FISA Act and the court that was created related to it that basically said the NSA can never spy on anyone in America using any technology that's available to it without a warrant from this secret court inside the Justice Department.
And Peter Baker of the New York Times describes the NSA as very cautious, fighting with one arm behind its back.
There was inside this agency, much to my surprise, that when we got to know who worked there and who they were, there are a lot of the kind of pocket protector kind of scientists. You know, 20,000 people working Fort Meade just outside of Baltimore in this really world of its own, with its own attached suburbs and everything. It's really an amazing environment. And a lot of the people who worked there believed they were patriots. And the ones that came in after the 70s and were there through 9/11 were people who I think really believed that their job was to protect America and felt that as technology technology, as the internet came along and other things came along, that they had sort of they couldn't connect what was probably happening in the world to what they knew or believed was probably happening in the United States, because they weren't allowed to tap into any of that information because of the prohibitions of the 70s. So there were a tremendous number of people there who were looking for ways to do it within the law, but doing it meant spying on anything that felt suspicious that was happening inside the U.S.
Well, looking back on 9/11, Edward Loomis, a former NSA engineer, comes to tears on your film. He seems to have felt that they could have prevented 9/11 attacks if there had been fewer restrictions. But despite that, didn't he have reservations about what the White House has done since?
Well, yes. You know, there were a lot of people like Ed Loomis who thought that they had invented a kind of elegant program that would gather information on everybody. But that it had built into it a kind of encryption process. They called it, they invented a word called anonymizing technology that would encrypt who was making the calls until somebody had a warrant, and then they could go down inside and find out what it was. But they had felt that they had invented a system, but the lawyers at the NSA worried about the backlash from the 70s. I wouldn't let them, as they say, put it into the fight. But Loomis and others really believe that if their program, their idea, would have been implemented, they could have stopped 9/11. They would have identified the people that were in the United States, the hijackers that were in the United States, and of course we'll never know.
Well, Alberto Gonzalez says that they didn't know about the 9/11 terrorists, but hadn't there been reports on Osama bin Laden, Mohammed Atta, and the others? In fact, Bill Clinton tried to have bin Laden killed years before 9/11.
Exactly. The thing that broke everybody's heart at the NSA, and part of what was behind their impetus to want to get as aggressive as they could, was they discovered within the hours after the attack, as they began to look and examine what they did have on hand, you know, they discovered that some of the hijackers were living in a motel right in the shadow of the NSA out in the Baltimore suburbs, that they were using ATMs in the neighborhood, that they had captured signals intelligence from a safe house in Yemen into a telephone number in San Diego. But of course, because of the rules, they weren't allowed to explore what they call hops from that phone in San Diego to other subsequent phones, and they believed that the San Diego telephone was a connection to some of the other hijackers on the East Coast. And they also grabbed, you know, off the web phrases like "the game is on" and "tonight's the night" and things like that that just broke all their hearts, because they had it, but they didn't search for it, they didn't know how to use it, and in fact, in some cases, they couldn't use what they felt they needed to use. So this allowed them, I think, psychologically to say, we'd like to take the gloves off, we'd like to get involved in this, we'd like to go protect America. If you'll recall, Leonard, and I know you do, the phrase sleeper cells, which everyone was hearing in those immediate days and weeks right after. Well, these people at the NSA, the crypto linguists and mathematicians, believed they could figure out a way to help the government discover those sleeper cells.
I'm speaking with Michael Kirk about a PBS Frontline show, actually two-parter, called The United States of Secrets, How the Government Came to Spy on Millions of Americans. The first will be broadcast tomorrow night at 9. It's 2 hours, and it really goes step by step into this story. But after the USA Patriot Act was passed, there were news reports that people in the Bush administration had wanted more surveillance authority from the first days that they'd come into office before the attacks. Does that undermine claims that the program was just a response to 9/11?
Well, there's a, you know, there's a fascinating side story, which it's not really a side story. It's right at the epicenter of the story, but it's a, it, it takes us away from Fort Meade and down into the Oval Office at the White House, and really not the Oval Office itself, but right next door to it in the Vice President's office, where we by now know, and I've made a couple of films in the past about the role of Vice President Cheney and his top legal advisor, David Addington. And Cheney and Addington had worked together back since Iran-Contra when Cheney was in Congress, and both big believers in executive power, both believers that the president, in the case of an emergency, should have authorities that allowed him to conduct, independent of Congress and the courts, all kinds of things, including espionage. And in a way, what 9/11 provided for them was the opportunity to act on what it was that they had been hankering to do for a long, long time.
And David Addington, as you say, Vice President Cheney's lawyer, wrote the legal argument for increasing domestic monitoring authority, setting this program into effect. Why Addington and not President Bush's lawyer?
Well, that's the it used to be $64,000 question, whatever it is now. Inflation, that is the big question. And many people we talked to were simply astonished. Of course, they did it in secret. This was perhaps the best-kept secret of the certainly the Bush administration, but maybe many administrations. It was a decision made by the vice president and his lawyer to write a document which was then signed by the President of the United States and the Attorney General, reauthorized in some cases for years, every 45 days or so, that was essentially a license to, and kept under lock and key, by the way, in the Vice President's lawyer's office, and a copy of it out at Fort Meade in Director Michael Hayden's office, read by very few people in the administration, literally the closest held secret that they had, authorizing the massive wiretapping, eavesdropping, surveillance of everything.
And there was some
in the world.
And some people were uneasy about this, but they got the FISA court, at least one judge of the FISA court, Colleen Collar-Cotelli, to rule secretly that the mass collection was legal, and then that made it okay.
Well, it's an incredible saga, and you know, when the Snowden revelations came out a year ago, I was sitting there saying, "Well, how do we explain first why this guy did what he did, and second, why many Americans, according to the polls, didn't seem to care very much about their own privacy being invaded here, and when we realized that what we had to do was go all the way back to 9/11 and those days immediately following, and the authorization and the taking of the gloves off, both at the CIA and at the NSA. How did all of that, we're all familiar now, I guess, those of us who followed with the John Yoo story and all of that at the Justice Department, but to take it right into the heart of Cheney's office and to realize how ambitious the program was and how they all wanted to do it, and then over years hid it, secretly kept it, pushed away the New York Times, pushed away everybody who kind of got close to it, whistleblowers. We spent a lot of time with five whistleblowers out of the NSA who were themselves unnerved by it all, to say the least. And by the time it gets to the Times revelations about it, and it feels, and 12 people or 14 people or 18 people, the number varies all the time, at the Justice Department who had threatened to resign, including, apparently, the Attorney General, and certainly Bob Mueller, the head of the FBI, if the program wasn't stopped. This happens in 2004. When all of that is happening, and the President of the United States, and we don't know about it, those of us out in the world don't know about it, and the President has to do something, one of the things he does is turn it off for a little while, but then sends Hayden from the NSA over to Judge Collar-Cotelli, and they work it out over a couple of Saturdays using a kind of arcane United States Supreme Court decision, 25-year-old decision that many find a stretch to justify the existence and the re-energizing of the program bigger and better than ever.
We have to take a little break. We'll come back with more Michael Kirk. The show, the United, or film, investigative report, The United States of Secrets, How the Government Came to Spy on Millions of Americans, will be broadcast, the first part anyway, tomorrow on PBS at 9. And then the second part will be broadcast next Tuesday at 10. Stay with us for more. We're back with Michael Kirk, and we're talking about a frontline show called The United States of Secrets, How the Government Came to Spy on Millions of Americans. The first part will be broadcast tomorrow night at 9 p.m., and then the second next Tuesday at 10. You mentioned some whistleblowers. What did they have in common other than the fact that they were concerned and rather upset by the changes? Many of these people rather conservative themselves.
It is very much the case that these are the pocket protector people that I was talking about. In most cases, they're crypto linguists, crypto mathematicians, highly educated, true believers, certainly what you would call conservatives in the classic definition of their politics, and many of them work there for 30, in some cases 40 years. And they really were heartbroken by what they saw happening in the hallways right after 9/11. New servers were arriving. Lots of people had been compartmentalized away from what was happening, which was clearly a dark secret. And as their friends and others would whisper to them in the lunch line, there's something happening here that I don't really like. There's something we're doing that feels wrong. It feels like we're taking what we used to use as gear to spy on the world, and we're now turning it on American citizens. And as I'd said at the beginning, Leonard, there was a bright white line painted out there since the 70s, since the Nixon administration, that something like this was not supposed to happen. And as they saw that going away and wondered what the authority was they were operating under, many began to worry about criminal behavior, that the agency that they loved and that they cared a lot about was now engaged in criminal activity, which is spying on the American people.
So what happened when these people, Thomas Drake, William Binney, Diane Rourke, Jack Goldsmith, Edward Loomis, went to the higher-ups and expressed their concerns?
The people who worked at the NSA recognized what all of us, anybody who's ever had a complaint about anything that the government recognized, which is it is a bureaucracy and it didn't want to hear it. Certainly in the case of Tom Drake, who was a very high-ranking official at the NSA, whose very first day was September 11th. He'd worked there as a contractor before. Drake finds what he thinks of as a really good program that protects people and that should be put into the fight. When he discovers that, when he takes it to his boss and says, here's a really good idea, protects Americans' privacy, but it's a thing we need, she, rather bureaucratically, doesn't want to talk to him, doesn't want to write an email to him, doesn't want to put anything down electronically. And in those days, in that agency, when you wanted to say something but you didn't want any record of it, you wrote it on a whiteboard with a felt pen. And in this case, her name is Maureen Baginski. She writes, they've decided to go another way, but she wouldn't tell Drake what it was. And in the hallways and in other ways, he was powerful enough to be able to ferret out what was happening. And what he discovered was the existence of the program. And even he, for years, didn't know the level of secrecy that was surrounding it or what it was. But as he took it up the chain of command, he got all the way up to the deputy counsel, the number two lawyer, Vito Potenza. And Potenza tells us on camera that even if Drake did say all those things and questioned the constitutionality of it, he didn't think that was Drake's purview, and he wouldn't have listened to it, and he didn't listen to it.
And so, Drake and William Binney, the guy who put together that program, Thin Thread,
right,
they wound up becoming whistleblowers. The other ones also got in trouble, and their homes were raided.
all of a sudden, so this all is a slight precursor to the raid, and that is that the New York Times finally decides to run the story. They've spiked it for 1 year in 2004, but Jim Risen, the famous investigative reporter from the Times, with Erich Lichtblau, they had researched the story in 2004. It spiked by Bill Keller. It comes back
spiked
to life
because the Bush administration asked them not to do it for national security reasons, although some people thought it was because it was an election year.
Well, and for other reasons that Keller says in our film, he's pulled into a handful of meetings with authorities from the administration who basically pull out the list. They say it's constitutional, and this is Condi Rice and, you know, well-known, highly regarded people inside the administration. So if you're an editor from the New York Times, it's completely plausible you would sit in a room with people like this and not expect them to mislead you. They said it's completely constitutional. The legality of it has been established. It's working. And then the biggest threat of them all, which is if you reveal this, the blood will be on your hands in the subsequent attack that will happen because we're helping the enemy. Keller decides that all seems about right, and he spikes the story. The extent to which it had anything to do with an election year, they argue both sides of that story. It isn't until Risen decides to write a book and name a chapter in the book, The Program, revealing the existence of this program, that the Times realizes, our reporter has us between a rock and a hard place here. We can't very well let his book go out, and we didn't write the story. So they try to walk it back and do decide to try to write the story. And again, just before they roll it, the President of the United States summons them to the White House on a dark and stormy December night, where once again he lays the threat out about this is the blood of Americans will be on your hands if you roll this story. But of course they do, and when they do, rolling out of the story is what finally in the end gets everything else going.
Do we know if any Americans' blood was spilled as a result of James Risen and Erich Lichtblau's reports in the book?
Well, not only do we not know the answer to that, but we don't know the answer to the efficacy question either. Has it saved any lives? Bill Keller tells us the story of what was happening in the Oval Office when Mike Hayden tries to answer the question that is presented by the Times, which is, so is this really saving? Is this really saving lives? Is this really effective? And he tells the story of somebody who, the sum and substance is somebody who they've uncovered, who had a blowtorch kind of device and was going to try to drop the Brooklyn Bridge with it. Keller says that even their memory is that even the President of the United States, President Bush, smirked when that was all Hayden.
That'd have to be a very powerful blowtorch.
You can only imagine that somebody in New York might have said, "What are you doing there?"
Put down that blowtorch.
Put down that blowtorch, sir.
Michael Kirk, we're talking about the United States of Secrets, how the government came to spy on millions of Americans. The first of a two-part series will be broadcast tomorrow night as part of the PBS Frontline series, and then the second part the following Tuesday. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, one of the other people we've talked about, Thomas Drake, actually went to the Baltimore Sun, and they did publish some stories, and he wound up being prosecuted not by the Bush administration, but by the Obama administration.
Well, this is the moment that, you know, so here's this guy. He publishes, he gives a reporter at the Baltimore Sun, Siobhan Gorman, unclassified material, but kind of guides her through some of what's going on. There's a USA Today report that comes out right after the New York Times finally reports in 2005. The story has sort of legs, but it doesn't really. And what happens is not that that the vice president and others say, okay, well, let's, you know, all right, we give up, and it's been revealed, it's what you should all know about it, let's have a national debate. What actually happens is that they unleash the FBI to pursue Drake, Binney, and all the others who were the whistleblowers rather than the people who created the program. And the whistleblowers literally used their life savings. Their houses are raided. Binney himself is in the shower when an FBI agent slides the curtain back and says, you know, step out of there. The worst possible moment for some of these people, former, you know, remember, these are the pocket protector people. These are the former patriots, the people who've worked there all their lives. And now the government has turned on them. Their savings are used up, worrying about indictments. Yeah, their families are distraught. In one case, Ed Loomis loses his marriage. Many, many horrible things happen to all of them. And in the end, the indictment falls on Tom Drake. And it's an indictment for espionage, 35 years in prison, based on the idea that if they could get him to flip and turn over any of the other guys, for what? Not for any horrible thing other than leaking to the New York Times. And, of course, Risen tells us in the film that they were not his sources. He had no idea who they were.
Well, it's interesting that the information that Drake spilled was all not top secret, but then the government made it top secret ex post facto.
That is what destroys his case in the end, is when they hire Drake's attorneys. His public defender hires Jim Banford, James Banford, the well-known author of Puzzle Palace and other great NSA books. And Banford looks at the documents that have been supposedly stolen by Drake and have in his possession top-secret documents, and he looks at them and finds them on the web, unclassified, and put on the web by the government itself. And what they allege and then what they seem to prove is that what the government did was grab them from Drake's house, decide that, well, even though they said unclassified on them, they're actually classified material, draw a line through the stamp that says unclassified on the bottom of at least one document, and then assert that he was in possession of top secret material. It's like he was framed, and the case falls apart. Drake, after losing his life savings and everything else, and ending up working at an Apple store in a mall in Maryland at the Genius Bar, Drake pleads out, gets a $25 court fee and a year's community service, and is, you know, like all of them, broken by the experience of trying to step up and say, wait a minute, something bad is going on in the government. And instead of anybody, from his point of view, anybody in the government being arrested or indicted, he's arrested and indicted for trying to speak up. They all believe that President Obama coming in will fix that, because he's been so pro-whistleblower in the campaign, very much like one person in the film says, he's like a University of Chicago law professor or an ACLU lawyer about all of these issues. But after he gets elected, he says to Eric Holder in the Justice Department, aggressively, go get these people. And that's what happens.
And did that affect the way Edward Snowden approached whistleblowing? Was he watching what happened to Thomas Drake?
Yes. I mean, what we discovered about Snowden, which is fascinating, is here's the first, I think this is probably completely accurate, here's the first whistleblower who actually takes a job intentionally to steal the documents, the proof of what he's angry about, what he's upset about. In the process, he reads when he's working in Japan in a secret location in Japan. Remember, he's worked for the CIA, he's worked for the NSA, and now he's in a contractor capacity. So he's part of that new army of young computers, wise and smart brainiacs who populate this war on terror from our top secret America perspective. Well, he's sitting there. He pulls down a draft Inspector General report that lays out the whole story you and I have been talking about. He reads it. It lights the candle. He says, wait a minute. And he sees what happens with the New York Times, and they don't publish their story. He sees what happened with Drake and the other whistleblowers, and he sees, even though they've sacrificed basically their lives and their careers for this, the American people don't seem to really, the story doesn't really have legs. It's one piece of paper here and there. So he says to himself, according to people we talked to who watched it all happen or know him very well, that he at that moment says, all right, I'm going to gather so much information that people, and it will roll out over such a period of time that the drip, drip, drip of it is going to make people believe that this is as big and bad as I can see that it is from reading these reports. And that's what starts him going. And he decides Drake and those, because Drake and those guys didn't have real paper, the kind of paper that Snowden gave to Bart Gellman and Laura Poitras and Glenn Greenwald a year ago.
And we will be following up on this tomorrow when Glenn Greenwald is a guest on our show. President Bush insisted that constitutional protections were in place and that warrants were obtained for every wiretap. Did he know that was untrue when he said it? I'm going to continue. In 2002, Michael Hayden testified that surveillance in the U.S. was done consistent with the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA. That also wasn't true. And after the Times did report some of the details of the program in 2005, the Bush administration continued to misrepresent the facts, to lie, as Thomas Drake and Jane Mayer say in the film. Why do you think, well, first of all, how much do you think George Bush actually knew about what was going on? And second of all, what did they hope to accomplish by lying about it other than to keep it secret for all of that time?
Well, the answer to the first question, what did President Bush know and when did he know it? You know, to answer the question, you start to sound like Don Rumsfeld a little bit. It's, you know, the known unknown. We don't know what he didn't know, but we're pretty sure from what happens. There's a scene in the film, I won't go into any detail about it, but where Jack Goldsmith, who's a lawyer, who's the head of the Office of Legal Counsel, very secretive, very powerful, part of the Department of Justice, has read the program and said, this is, portions of this are unconstitutional. You just can't go forward with this. And he and other lawyers tell first David Addington, the vice president's lawyer, and then the vice president, and then, of course, eventually George Bush, that you got to turn the program off. And they say it forcefully enough that, you know, they all threaten to resign. You know, 24 of them, including Bob Mueller, head of the FBI, all threatened to resign in March of 2004. And if that would have happened, one can only imagine what would happen to the Bush presidency during an election year. Well, the president sits with the deputy attorney general, the acting attorney general, Jim Comey, and he says, how come you guys didn't tell me this earlier? I mean, this is the day before the authorization is going to end. And Comey realizes at that moment that the president of the United States does not know anything about the constitutional crisis and the presidential crisis that's been brewing in his White House for almost 3 months while they negotiated with Cheney and Addington about what parts of the program should be kept and what couldn't live. It's then that he says to the president, you've not been served very well by the people around you, and that would include Cheney, Addington, Andy Card, and maybe even Alberto Gonzalez. So the president then, I think it helps us understand the question of what did the president know and when did he know it.
Although
he apparently didn't know at the level of detail that when you watch the film, you will know when you see that moment happen.
Although he obviously knew a lot about it afterward. But we can't go into any more because we've run out of time. I'm so sorry, Michael. This is so much fun, I guess. Michael Kirk, we've been talking about the PBS Frontline show, part one, The United States of Secrets, How the Government Came to Spy on Millions of Americans, airs tomorrow night at 9 p.m., and then part two next Tuesday at 10. Michael, thank you so much for being on our show.
My pleasure, Leonard. Thank you.